Welcome to Peak Health Unlocked, a docuseries show interviewing experts to unpack the latest science, technology, and wellness practices, all with the purpose of helping you unlock your peak health. This show would not be possible without the support of Thrive Performance and Regenerative Medicine, a team prepared to go all in to craft your personalized peak health plan. Visit the link in the show notes to start your health transformation. Enjoy the show. Dr. David Hasse is a Vanderbilt and Mayo-trained physician who believes that the first step to solving this decade's foremost medical challenges is asking the right questions. His passion to understand the human body, not as an isolated set of organs and processes, but as an awesomely complex dynamic system, helps him uncover root causes of chronic illness in each unique patient. All right, so let's jump in. First question every guest is getting on this series, and that is, how do you define immunity?
Wow, yeah, immunity. Well, I always talk with my patients, I describe it as your immune system is your department of defense. So immunity is defense. And as long with a department of defense, the more activity you have on the front line, the more opportunity there is for friendly fire, for the actual forces that are doing the defense against the outside world to cause harm to the host itself. And so immunity is just a necessary process in order for any individual life form to exist in a world of life forms that either view it as food or as fuel. And so one needs to have a defense against the attack of other life forms. We don't really think about it conceptually that way all the time, but it really helps to think that it is a process that is absolutely necessary for life, but because it actually causes destruction and death itself, it in many times is our own seed of destruction.
Powerful.
Yeah. Wow. We could just wrap it up right there, huh?
And that's it.
Well, I'll be fine. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, that's a wrap. No, Dr. Hasse, that was awesome. We have a lot to talk about. Obviously, I want to just ask a general question and let the viewers or the listeners, know why we think you're so cool and why we wanted you on the podcast. Aww. I'm just going to hit you with a general question. So can you just explain in your own words what you guys do at your clinic or even the style of medicine that you practice? Because I find it to be very interesting and unique.
Yeah, well, it is unique. So I've been obsessed with this whole idea about how do we create health for over 25 years. I started out at Vanderbilt Medical School, Mayo Clinic, practiced at Mayo for a time, and just recognized that, wow, excellent diagnosis and treatment of disease is super important, but our bodies are designed to heal. And I found it far more fascinating to figure out, well, what is impairing our body's natural ability to create health? And then to structure our data gathering and our interventions around that as a theme. And this has gone through many different iterations, because when you're marching down a road that hasn't been traveled very often before, you find different tools along the way. So what has emerged after, getting certified as one of the first holistic medical physicians in the United States. And then I'm certified as a functional medicine doc, and I help run the certification program for the Institute for Functional Medicine. And I'm board certified in integrative medicine and neurofeedback and apheresis. But really what I do, I call it personalized systems medicine. We want to recognize that, and we do this at the Maxwell Clinic in Nashville, Tennessee. And our personalized systems medicine is an approach of looking at each individual as a system of systems. And by looking at them multidimensionally, you know, molecularly, structurally, psychologically, spiritually, sociologically, genetically, electrophysiologically, and kind of layering those on top of each other and seeing how those systems interact with other systems, having a dense curiosity, you know, just a ridiculous level of curiosity of what is the most direct path to healing for this person. One of my pet peeves is, you know, practitioners that find this great hammer and now everything becomes a nail. Right. And I think that that's one of the big fallacies of anything that is considered to be holistic, because as soon as somebody has a worldview that recognizes people are complete and whole beings, they think that being holistic means that they can treat the whole list. And that's really not the way, that's really not the way it works. It's a great perspective to see people as whole creatures, but more than anything, it, after some reflection, it causes one to really be humbled at the miraculous complexity of a human and its multiple capacities to heal from many different directions. So what I do is highly patient-centered. I do exceedingly deep dive work with a very few number of clients, not giving up until we found and addressed underlying causes of disease, and a very highly customized and personalized approach. And then I have multiple other clinicians that work with me that I mentor and teach, and that are just amazing clinicians in their own right, each with their own focus and emphasis. And it's fun. I enjoy practicing medicine, I think, more than any doctor I know, because I get to work with highly proactive, dedicated, and engaged patients.
It's beautiful.
Mark, I know you have a question. Let me just paraphrase that real quick. In summary, he's a real doctor.
can I tell a little story about that though? Just a minute. It's really important, because I have a huge amount of thankfulness for the dean of my, the dean of student life at Vanderbilt when I was a medical student. The first day of medical school, she stood up there in her white coat, and she's just a short little thing, powerhouse of a dynamo physician. Deborah German was her name. And she wrote on the board, "The Good Doctor." And then she turned around to all of us newbies, you know, first year medical students. She said, "All right, what is the good doctor?" And we start calling things out from the room. It's like, oh, patient, kind, smart, hardworking, compassionate, you know, inquisitive, blah, blah, blah. And the list got massive, right? It was all of a sudden, all of us feel this crushing weight of like, oh my God, I'm never going to get that. And then she turned around and she said the most beautiful thing. And it was a major tipping point in kind of my medical career. She said, "Your job from now on is to continue to ask this question of yourself. What is it for you to be the good doctor?" And this just happens to be my own expression of that. It's not the right way. It happens to be my way. And but this is kind of how I really try to be the good doctor in my own way.
Beautiful. Mark, real quick before you ask your question, because I want to confirm what Dr. Hasse was saying when he described himself. And I met him at a brain optimization conference. And I truly can confirm that after watching him speak, he has so much passion and compassion, not only for his patients in medicine, but other physicians, and like getting physicians information and helping them and raising the collective consciousness of what it means to be a good doctor. So, and fun little note, side fact, I witnessed this man give some of the best hugs that I have ever seen. I have not received one yet, but I'm hoping the next time we meet, I can really settle in on one of these embraces, because they're truly, truly amazing if you ever get to see it. And whoever gets these hugs are like, wow, they leave a better person,
a damn, I think. Good hug.
Well, I mean, listen, we are healing creatures. We really are. And one of the most potent forces of healing is to know that somebody really cares. And it's healing to the person who cares as much as it's healing to the person that is being cared for. So, you know, there's a bit of selfishness in it for me, because to feel that connection with another person and to be open to that, I think our world needs a bit more of that.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Yeah, I think we'd all concur on that one. The question I wanted to ask, it's very much related to a lot of what you shared, I believe, but was just to understand when your curiosity shifted to a whole other level. Because what I was hearing, just based on when you describing how you're working and the clinic and all the other projects that you're involved in, it seems like it's a different level of curiosity than what I'm assuming most go through in medical school to, you know, diagnose what's happening in the body or very acute scenarios versus this whole systems definition that you described.
Yeah. Well, you know, curiosity has been something my mother will tell you I've never been in short supply of. And so I am that kid who tore everything apart and always had to know why, and had to know why behind the why. And that's kind of, you know, both my blessing and my curse. I ended up writing a book called Curiosity Heals the Human, because I really think that, you know, asking better questions is the first step to getting better answers. And a lot of times we get stuck with bad questions, so we don't get great answers. But as far as curiosity goes, I have a deep love affair with reality. I think it's so amazing how to just sit and consider, you know, how a plant grows, or the fact that we can eat a piece of food and in about 3 or 4 hours, it becomes part of a human. That's amazing. I mean, how does that stuff happen, for heaven's sakes? And we can, and the more reductionist we get with it, just the more amazing it reflects back on the holism. So systems medicine for me is really a way of us honoring both the fact that really like an indigenous way of thought, that the whole is what matters, and also honoring a Western style approach that the parts are what matter. The system is really how all of that is connected together. And I can't say that there was a single tipping point, except for every patient I've ever seen. Because, you know, when you get to sit knee to knee with a infinitely valuable, ultimately important, human, you know, this thing that has never existed on the face of the planet before, a complete, a unique genetic makeup and a unique environmental exposure that has occurred over the course of time to bring this unique phenotype, which is the phenotype is kind of what you see, to bring that into the presence of a physician, and then to get to engage all of the unique perceptions and biases that that individual has, and to seek out, to figure out what are their goals, and then what are the goals behind their goals, and then what are the things that are impeding them from getting where they want to go. That is fun. I mean, it's the best puzzle that exists for a person who's obsessed with solving puzzles.
Very cool. And that really resonates with us, the indigenous wisdom, because we describe our own practice as being one part ancestral wisdom, which are all the basics, and then another part, all the new innovative science breakthroughs and tech that you put, that's like the icing on the cake. But at its basis, we really try to look at ancestral wisdom as our guiding principle, and then layer on all these other systems as you're discussing. But so just to shift gears a little bit to dive into immunity. So recently, you know, we're in the pandemic, and a major regulatory agency had said that you could not boost your immune system. They were warning against that. Just wanted to get your thoughts on, are we able to boost our immune system? And if so, what are some of the things that we can do to boost that, as far as like nutrients, vitamins, maybe behavioral changes, things of that sort?
Yeah. I mean, I think the word boost is a stupid word, you know, I mean, because the immune system is your Department of Defense. It's incredibly dynamic. It is, has many different subsections. There are areas that you would want activated and areas that you would want suppressed at any one time. COVID right. really has about four different phases of active, you know, from viral acquisition to viral replication to tissue injury to inflammation resolution. And in each of those different phases require a different aspect of your immune system to be robust. And I mean, this is just like the, I get so tired of clickbaity kind of blogs, you know, that want to give some sensational, oh, you know, supplements are, you know, expensive urine, or, you know, science says, and you go like, you know, you guys are just a bunch of idiots because, you know, you're here to get clicks, not to help people gain wisdom. And wisdom is sipping back and saying and looking at all the data that is present. So, and I will say that sales happen when you make things simple, right? You know, in the world of sales, it's always said, hey, don't make it too complex or you'll lose the sale. And so that's also what our capitalist kind of economy does. It wants to reduce it down. Oh, here's this single pill for your ill, and cha-ching, a sale's been made, and the machine goes on. However, the remarkable thing is our immune system, when it is at its best, is highly adaptive, and it is able to it is able to accelerate and downshift and hit the brakes when necessary in individual components. So I'm going to give maybe a different answer than a lot of people would make. I think that omega-3 fatty acids are incredibly important. And we have a broad deficiency of these omega-3 fatty acids because they are the raw material for the off switch for inflammation. And I know vitamin D and zinc and N-acetylcysteine, and there's a whole bunch of, you know, you can talk about herbal extracts till the cows come home. But at the end of the day, what kills people for COVID is inflammation and tissue hypoxia from, you know, glycocalyx destruction. And I think if we can decrease inflammation, or if we can enable our body to hit the off switch, turn, you know, make the resolvins and the defensins, which are molecules that come off of omega-3 fatty acids, we have a great opportunity to have an immune system that's active and aggressively causing cellular destruction when it needs to be doing that for the benefit of the organism, and then being able to turn off effectively when that need is done.
Yeah, and we've had people ordering more fast food during the pandemic than we've had ever, right? So that kind of goes against omega-3.
It's going to kick up their omega-6s.
So. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and also trans fats in there. And then the fast food has many of those fats have been put under very high heat, so they've been oxidized. And oxidized fats, you know, have a direct inflammatory response. High doses of saturated fats can increase lipopolysaccharides secretion into the gut, causing increased inflammation going to the brain. And I've got a lot to talk about immune function in the brain. So because I think that is an area that we forget about a lot in the whole immune health cascade.
That's all I needed to say. Go.
Yeah, I know Mark would be really interested in that. So please do tell. Let us hear what you got to say, please.
Oh, well, I mean, well, there you go. I did my own intro. So
You nailed it.
You just guide this conversation.
You're here for the ride. That's good. You know, all of that talking in my own head is paying off, obviously. And yeah, I.
You always win your arguments in the shower.
If I don't, then I need to. That's the time I need to have some serious therapies. If I'm the only one that's arguing, then I better be the winner. So the immune system. You know, people ask. I do a lot of work with dementia. And we're pioneering a therapy to reverse Alzheimer's disease. And we've got great data on it. It's the most promising therapy, I think, that has come out in ever. And it's kind of called plasma exchange. And it's actually a procedure rather than a drug or anything like that. And it got to it really through a very interesting series of events. And one of those was the recognition that autoimmune dementia is a very often misdiagnosed, treatable cause of dementia. And there are some wonderful panels that Mayo puts out and some other laboratories that can diagnose an autoimmune forms of dementia. And these tend to be more aggressive and early. But plasma exchange, what we're now utilizing to treat dementia and other neurodegenerative diseases, is really a, utilizing plasma exchange is the standard of care for severe autoimmune disease. So if somebody has Guillain-Barré syndrome or neuromyelitis optica, or where their neurologic system is getting chewed up by the antibodies that are forming in your immune system, you do plasma exchange, which is you put an IV in one arm, pull blood out, separate the blood from the plasma, or separate the cells from the plasma, and you discard that old plasma that has in it damaged proteins and antibodies that are aggressively attacking the body and oxidative stress, etc. And you mix those red blood cells of the body with a clean replacement fluid. And then this newly reconstituted clean blood is then returned into the body. And this goes in a continuous circuit until you've actually removed nearly the full volume or even more of the patient's original plasma. So you're cleaning the blood. And in these cases of autoimmune dementia and autoimmune other neurologic diseases, you can have dramatic improvement by removing those damaged molecules and those antibodies. But so it really blew my mind. It's like, wow, here is this therapy that the standard indications for are severe autoimmune disease, and it's also showing this remarkable progress, a promise in dementia. It took me into, wow, I actually have kind of renamed Alzheimer's disease in my own head. And I believe it is age-related immunodementia. Alzheimer's disease has it's an immune dysfunction. And a beta amyloid, this molecule that we all blame, is actually an antimicrobial peptide. When the body starts to produce it, it is kind of our backup system for the other parts of the immune system that have gone offline. Because as we age, our cellular immune defense starts to wane. It gets less and less effective. And if the cells of the immune system aren't doing their job, the body starts to ooze out these peptides, namely beta amyloid, that is able to neutralize and kill all kinds of infections. But unfortunately, these peptides start to aggregate together and plaques develop, and then more cellular injury occurs. And the inflammation from these chronic infections that are in the brain and in the body perpetuate this process to move forward. So you get a multiple common systems failure that is Alzheimering. So Alzheimer's disease, we shouldn't call it Alzheimer's disease. We should call it Alzheimering, because it's really a process that's going on. And if we're able to engage this and be curious about the immune aspect of dementia, I think there's huge, huge potentials for slowing, stopping, and reversing the neurodegenerative diseases.
Is there any one few things that you've seen right now that are driving that immune dysfunction? Yeah, anything in our diet, Western diets, anything in our lifestyles that you can identify?
Oh man, the list is long, right?
Yeah. The main ones that we can modify.
Wow, yeah. I mean, stress and inflammation. Man, if you take care of stress and inflammation, you know, there's not a whole lot left for the diseases of modern man. And so, you know, if I think, is there any one thing? I can pick one. You know, when I think of inflammation, I think of five main causes. I think of infections, toxins, allergens, injury, or nutrient deficiencies. Those are really the five categories that we start to be curious about. And I think more than say, oh, there's one thing, I think is get it quantified. Number one, do you have any disease that ends with an itis? Right? Do you have a dermatitis? Do you have a colitis? Do you have a periodontitis? Do you have iritis? It's kind of fun to kind of play the game of point to a part in your body and tell the disease name that is inflammation of that part, right?
Right.
But really, it's just one process. Inflammation is inflammation is inflammation. And inflammation anywhere in the body is sending out alarm messages to the rest of the body, saying, hey, you know, this battalion is under attack. Everybody else go on red alert. And that changes the tenor of the entire immune system. So what any itis that is present localized in your body is signaling more itis to perpetuate in the rest of your body. You know, I think one thing that gets missed oftentimes is the fact that foods have a massive propensity to increase inflammation, and especially dairy. You know, wheat gets a lot of, you know, I'm going to say, hey, wheat is really challenging for many people, but especially when it comes to the brain, dairy can cause a lot of issues. You know, I think it's time that humans wean at about the same age other mammals wean, you know, get off the teat. And so, because we weren't meant to ingest these folate receptors long-term and develop folate receptor binding antibodies and decrease cerebral folate. And oh my gosh, the cascade of events that happens, when we're trying to trick nature, is a little bit challenging. So.
Is this all dairy? So cheese, hard cheeses, aged cheeses, all the everything?
I really am a quality of life advocate. So I'm not going to be the guy that says, oh, this is always bad. Absolutely not. Because my job is to help people live the life that they want to live. And sometimes, you know, they have a total commitment to continuing to eat dairy. And so sometimes they can be well and sometimes they can't. I would say that the more, you know, aged, fermented dairy products are, the less they less like the original breast milk was. So it's less problematic. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dr. Hasi, if you you know, if you decide you're going to become a root cause holistic doctor at some point in that career, you end up becoming an inflammologist. Does that, would you echo that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. If you don't become that, you need to find another profession because it is such a final common pathway for so many of the concerns that we have.
I'd like to talk because you mentioned stress as being one of the two big buckets. And I mean, even just speaking with you over the last 30 minutes, I mean, I can already tell you're incredibly
given you stress.
Yeah, it's giving me high levels of stress.
It's giving me stress. Okay. All right. Sorry about that.
what I was going to say is you seem like a very present individual, and even, you know, the presence you shared when you're in front of a patient and being, you know, curious and fascinated and you know, to be that dialed into the person in front of you, there's a lot of mental presence there from what I'm gathering, which I, you know, as being someone that's passionate about mental fitness, that's a huge pillar in at least the work that I do. But I'd love to know how you approach stress with your patients and clients. Like where do you start? Because most people don't even know they're stressed.
Yeah. Well, for 18 years, I have done a heart rate variability assessment on every patient that's walked in my doors. And heart rate variability is a way for us to quantify kind of that parasympathetic to sympathetic balance that goes on in each individual. Sympathetic typically being what we think of as our fight, flight, or freeze response. And the parasympathetic, our feed, breathe, and repair response. And it's amazing. You do this little heart rate variability test, and it shows you a kind of in a quick and dirty way that there are some markers here that this person is in a state of fight or flight, and they're just sitting there, right? And there's no saber-toothed tiger at the door. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't whipped out, you know, a 3-inch needle or anything like that. They are in a physician's office, which, you know, does induce some kind of trauma for many people, which I'm sad to say. It's one of the reasons I refuse to wear a white coat.
Yeah.
But what's remarkable is that when individuals see that report and they go like, yeah, you know, you have a high degree, you're expressing a fight or flight neurologic response at this moment in time. And they go, well, I'm not stressed. I don't feel stressed. I'm not stressed. And so then we have a talk about leprosy. So leprosy is a really interesting, I actually was a physician in a leper colony in Africa when I was a young physician. Oh, and it was fascinating. And leprosy kills people by killing the nerves that help you sense pain. So you can't feel pain very well, especially in your peripheral. So in your fingers, your toes, it's such where it starts. And because you can't feel pain, if you happen to pick up a hot pot from the fire, that pot's just going to cook your hand until you happen to smell it cooking. And then you're going to pull it off and you're going to have a massive, massive deep injury. Whereas if you had a pain response, you'd immediately pull your hand back from it. Or you'd even feel the heat as your hand approached the pot. And or you maybe have a pebble in the bottom of your foot and you go walking and you erode this hole in the bottom of your foot. Just terrible. And then you get an infection, wow. Finally an amputation. Well, those people, you suffered loss of limb and then life as a result of not feeling pain. And I think many of us are walking around as stress lepers. We have stress. It is absolutely, it's just like that rock in the bottom of our shoe, but we're insensate. We don't feel the stress, and therefore it silently erodes, damages, and impairs our ability to protect ourselves. So one of the first things that needs to take place is to acknowledge that, yes, I am a stress leper, and I'm going to need some learning on how to recognize when I am in a state of recovery and repair and when I'm not. So there's some really great tools out there that are really mostly based around heart rate variability. I use heart math a lot. We have a great assessment called first beat analysis, which is a 72-hour heart rate variability assessment that you keep a journal and a diary with. And that comes off of EKG data, so it's very high fidelity. And that's great for counseling. And then you can use little things like the Muse's headband for mindful meditation, any kind of heart rate. There's all kinds of heart rate variability apps. You can put your finger on your on the light on your phone and it'll measure your heartbeat and do some paced breathing. Anyway, I just think it's remarkable how many people just don't know they're stressed, or it's become so culturally not even just acceptable, but rewarded or somehow admired if you're stressed.
It's the grind, and the hustle, all of that.
Yeah. It's like, wow, you got so much going on. Oh, you're so busy.
And you must be a big deal.
Yeah. Look at me, how stressed I am. Well, you know, all right, aren't I a life success? Whee! So. and so there we get ego coming in too, right? So, you know, sometimes if we don't know who we are as a human, we try to substitute it by what we do as our identity. And so stress gives us an opportunity to ask those questions. Are we open to knowing who we are? Do we know who we are? And where do we go from there?
As far as stress, you know, you probably institute a lot of different things for stress management, but one of the key things I would imagine that you would focus on would be sleep and optimizing sleep. And we know that when we're sleeping, our glymphatic system is working to clear out all the gunk out of our brain. Can you kind of touch on the importance of sleep, how you approach it, and what's going on at night with our brains?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you said some really important stuff. I mean, the glymphatic chains that were just identified, you know, 2-3 years ago, and these are the lymphatic channels inside the brain that open up when we get into states of deep sleep. It's profound how important it is for us to detoxify the brain. And our body needs to be in a clean out mode in order to open up those glymphatics. So if we've eaten just before we've gone to bed, the body's in a digest mode. It's not really trying to clean up. And so not eating before you go to bed within, you know, 3-4 hours in bed is really important, I think, towards quality of sleep, and especially your brain health around sleeping. I'm profoundly shocked by how many individuals that are between, 18 and 30 who are nocturnal. I mean, the sleep cycles have gotten so screwed up, and I can't help but believe it has a lot to do with just how much blue light exposure we're getting from our screens every day, mm-hmm. and how little natural light that we are being exposed to. That first natural light of the day, and if you can make a habit of waking up and seeing each sunrise, that as a core behavior will change the trajectory of your life in a way that you can't even begin to imagine. And because that natural going from a dark to a natural light, it changes you. It changes your signaling. It helps set up your circadian rhythm. And because life is really all about waveforms. You know, everything that is alive has a vibration to it, right? You have a respiratory rate. You have even a bowel peristalsis. You have day-night cycles. You have, cellular pulsations going down neurons. So life is really waves waving within waves. And when you get this day-night cycle locked in, all kinds of other rhythms can organize around it. If you don't have that one big rhythm nailed, if you don't prioritize that as exceptionally important for this task of being a human, you're never going to reach the heights of function that you are capable of.
That is poetic.
Yeah, that was profound right there. Yeah.
And we preach that to all of our clients as well. And I've actually experienced the health consequences of not doing that, because both Rhett and I are classically trained anesthesiologists. We're boarded in anesthesia. So for many years, we practiced anesthesia, and we would go in when it was dark and leave when it was dark. And the entire time, you're exposed to the unnatural light, and you're looking at computer screens and your phones and this and that, and you never got any sunlight. And I just got sicker and sicker. And my vitamin D was like 16 or something when I checked it back then. So when I left practice, anesthesia practice, the first thing I started doing was waking up and walking with the sunrise. And I just couldn't believe how much better I felt. So anytime I'm not doing anesthesia now, I really try to make that a practice. And I try to tell people about that, and they just kind of look at me glossy-eyed like, what? How is that going to make a difference? But I can tell you, it's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a foundation.
It is really a challenge, because, you know, so much of our culture is kind of set up around, you know, all the fun things happen at night. So I would encourage everybody, you know, people listening to this, make some morning dates with your friends. I mean, you know, set up going on morning walks with your friends. Get active. Social activity, even if it's insanely cold outside. Embrace the cold, you know, put on a coat, laugh about how nuts you are, get out there and see the morning sun with a friend, or build community. It's astounding how important activity is, light is, and daylight cycles. And we have to you know, we really have to reorder our life and create a community of people that support us as we are all helping each other move forward.
I agree. I mean, the other thing too, I find I've been an early riser for years now, and I just feel like there's a sense of accomplishment as well that goes with waking up at that hour when things are quiet, and it's almost as if you're starting the day on your own terms, right? Versus being thrusted into this crazy rat race where now you're essentially waking up into reactivity mode. It's a beautiful, peaceful time of day. And I agree with you. It's just, you know, make plans in the morning. Because I find, at least with me, if something comes up at night and it's a late hour event of some sort, it's got to be incredibly valuable to disrupt the 5:30 wake up, because I know how much I'm getting, you know, that first hour, an hour and a half in the day for myself.
Yeah. And a lot of that is really being clear on who are you and what are you here for? You know, and the clearer that you are on that, the better, the easier it is to say no to these other influences. And then with every no, you get to say more yeses to yourself. It really is about valuing yourself in these kind of anti-culture type engagements.
Dr. Hasse, I feel like you are reading from a Thrive script because you're literally saying all the things we implement here. But, you know, one of the things we look at are patterns. And on each podcast, no matter how sciencey we get, it always comes back to literally, I'm just going to recap what you said, which is the idea that being stressed is cool because that means you're grinding and you're successful. And I mean, even look amongst professionals where we prided ourselves. I mean, I was trained to pride myself in deprivation, which is the complete antithesis of what we're teaching people to do now. And then, you know, sleep being immensely undervalued. And so I'm sure Philip and Mark would agree that it always comes back to these central focus points in the conversation, to include community, to include waking up with the sun, you know, all sorts of things that are innate to human beings.
It's kind of these basic ancestral wisdom practices.
Yep. You know, reality has been reality for a long time. And things that have worked in the past for doing this thing called humaning are very likely to continue working now and in the future. And yeah, this is I like to, some people ask me, well, what kind of medicine do you practice? And if I'm feeling a little snarky, I tell them I practice no alternative medicine. And I said, there's, because there's really no alternative to you know, living joyfully and eating high quality food and nurturing your body with adequate and about properly timed sleep and drinking clean water and removing the wastes on a regular basis. You know, there's just no alternative to some of these ways of living.
Dr. Hasse, I do have a science-y question. At that conference, we had a conversation, and it's on the topic of glutathione. So if you can touch on what glutathione is. But we have a lot of clients coming in. Everybody's the new thing for all these drip or IV centers is glutathione injections, IV glutathione, and everybody thinks they need the glutathione in some supplement form. And you had a great, great explanation of glutathione and what's the best way to kind of boost it yourself from within. But definitely something the listeners need to hear, because this seems to be like a popular topic lately.
Yeah, you know, it's like I said, I'm I'm such an old timer. I mean, I laugh about how many times this kind of stuff comes and goes back and forth. I'm just kind of waiting for the next wave of anyway. But glutathione, glutathione is our master antioxidant. It is super important. It is involved in detoxification of a lot of electrophilic compounds, you know, heavy metals, mold toxins. It is an incredibly important molecule, and it flips in between a reduced state, which is its active state of an antioxidant and a detoxifier, and its oxidized state, which is kind of used up. And then it gets recycled back and forth. So now, if it's an antioxidant, you want it where the fire is going on. And where is the fire happening in your body? It's happening inside your cells and specifically inside your mitochondria. So about 15% of your body's entire storehouse of glutathione lives inside your mitochondria. And that glutathione has a it serves a very important purpose, but it has to be made there. It has to be made inside that mitochondria. And then a lot of glutathione is inside the cell itself, inside the cell wall, and it needs to be made from there. It doesn't get transported in very easily because it's a very simple molecule. It's much easier to make it on the spot where you need it. And so when people take oral glutathione, they go like, oh, I'm taking the oral glutathione, you know, most of the time, that's hitting the stomach and breaking down into its component amino acids. That was just a very expensive amino acid supplement. Sometimes in its acetylated form, you know, that can get inside the gut and be taken up in the chylomicrons, and nonspecific acetylases can break that down. And you can get some increased intracellular glutathione. You can take, you know, liposomal glutathione. And again, I think it gets to be mostly expensive amino acids. And glutathione can bind things in the gut if you're taking it orally. And you can take it IV and you can get this boost of glutathione. But, you know, there's not been many studies that shows that helps much. I mean, we do use it in Parkinson's patients. There is some data that if you get an IV twice a week and people who are symptomatically with Parkinson's, there is some improvement as long as you keep taking the IV glutathione, because I think that's making a difference in the brain. But otherwise than that, it's way more important to make your own glutathione. And for that, you need sulfur donors. The raw material N-acetylcysteine is a very inexpensive supplement. And we get sulfur in all kinds of foods, all the stinky foods, right? Broccoli, garlic, onions, eggs. You know, you get sulfur. And then you want to turn on the enzymes that make glutathione. So glutathione synthase and the enzymes that recycle glutathione. And you do that by turning on a gene cassette called NRF2. Well, NRF2 is stimulated by many different phytochemicals. The most powerful one is called sulforaphane. And Johns Hopkins basically discovered this and has done tons of research on a supplement form of sulforaphane. And we use a ton of it, OncoDetox, in our practice. And that is there to stimulate the activation of NRF2. And then that then turns on glutathione production inside the cells. There's some really good data on sulforaphane at high dose. It decreases the amount of actual benzene in the blood by half and increases the amount of benzene coming out in the urine by double. And that was done in the city of Beijing among Chinese. There's studies done in autism where we're seeing behavior improvements and social behavioral improvements in high dose sulforaphane as an antioxidant. You don't really get to see that with glutathione, but sulforaphane, it is the real stuff, is kind of expensive, but I think that's the direction we need to go. And also to encourage lots more cruciferous vegetables. Unfortunately, like one of our OncoDetox ES pills, it's about like the amount of sulforaphane in like 10 pounds of broccoli. So it gets hard to do that. Broccoli sprouts have a lot of sulforaphane, and there's some broccoli sprouts that are even grown to bring that level up.
Strong. Yeah. You know, one last total gear change here. Another specific question, because I know we want to respect your time. Something that we wanted to ask you about, and this is more, I think, in something that you have an interest in. Can you explain the difference between young plasma and plasma exchange?
Yeah. So like, as I said, we're doing a lot of plasma exchange for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. But one of the other trails of information about how this came to be was the studies on parabiosis. And this was, they took a young mouse and an old mouse that were clones of each other. And they did this little surgery that attached them side by side. And so they actually ran around their cage together, attached. And within about a week, a remarkable thing happened. That old mouse started to turn young. Skin started to become healthier. Liver began to regenerate. Kidney function improved. Muscle recovery to injury improved. And new neurogenesis began. The young mouse, however, that was attached to this old mouse, became poisoned by old. The young mouse got stunted by exposure to the old that was in the old mouse. Now, what is this old, man? We had a whole nother podcast for that. But at our clinic in Nashville, we do this plasma exchange, essentially trying to remove the old. And so when these two mice were together, the old mouse and the young mouse, two things were happening for the old mouse. You can think of it that old was being removed and young was being inserted by the plasma that they shared via this microcirculation. Well, several studies went forward. They took old mice and they injected them with the plasma of young mice. And sure enough, there was some activation, some health promotion activity there, some stem cell activation, and it had some of the same effects of doing this whole exchange. But even more remarkably, in recent studies published in Aging, they took these old mice and they did a plasma exchange on them. They pulled out their old plasma and then just replaced it with a replacement fluid filled with albumin and some other things. And lo and behold, with just one exchange, that old mouse's body-wide stem cells got a boost. And just with one exchange, that mouse had substantial long-term changes in brain health, muscle health, and liver health with a reversal of fatty liver disease, new neurogenesis, and more muscle growth. So again, you know, if you want to create health, you put your cells into their best environment because cells know how to live. And this is what we're doing when we do a plasma exchange, when we pull out old diseased plasma or plasma that has damaged molecules, misfolded proteins, markers of inflammation, signals of inflammation. When we remove that out, we unburden the body-wide stem cell network. And it turns out that those stem cells are activating body-wide. So we have many people coming to us for biohacking purposes, you know, saying, hey, I've read the basic science and we explain risks and benefits. And if it's appropriate, go through plasma exchange. And we've done a lot to actually improve our safety and optimization of the kind of fluid that goes in. One more thing. So young plasma, so kind of putting in the young, that actually can be done as well. The problem is the source of young plasma.
Right.
There was only one certified blood bank that was age segregating plasma and doing the necessary additional testing to, I think, make plasma safer as a therapeutic. And that, unfortunately, that one blood bank is closed. Before they did, I actually got to do a plasma exchange using, instead of albumin as a replacement fluid, I used young plasma as a replacement fluid in this Alzheimer's patient. And it was really quite remarkable. Within the course of about 2 to 3 weeks, she returned back to a state of function that she had been at nearly a year previous. She had improvement in her memory, improvement in her executive function, increased strength. And then COVID happened. And yeah. COVID caused the closure of the blood bank. And, you know, well, there's all kinds of stutters that happen in the development of methods to help health. But I think that therapeutic plasma exchange, like we do at Maxwell Clinic, I think it is going to become a foundation of all longevity practices. And we're working to understand how that can be done in its safest way. And we'll be training physicians eventually and helping to study this process as we move forward.
we hope to be two of those physicians that get to go to your center and learn from you. But so I would imagine these treatments are pretty expensive. Is there a would you get the same benefit of doing like plasma donation or blood donation just because you're getting rid of some of that old blood and old plasma?
We know that donating blood does have some benefit. Yes, we do. Donating plasma may have benefit as well. Absolutely. I don't think that there, but those studies really haven't been done. And when you're removing, when you're doing a blood donation, you're not getting necessarily fresh, clean albumin back. You're having to make your own. And if you're already aged, you may not have as much properly folded albumin. There's a lot to be learned. Albumin is a fascinating topic. Albumin is your number one antioxidant in your blood system, you know. Number one. Hmm. And so when your albumin gets damaged, your kind of antioxidant sink goes down. So albumin has massive, oh my gosh, it's another hour lecture. Because
definitely having you back on.
Details really matter.
Right.
But when you talk about expense, it costs anywhere from $80,000 to $120,000 to have 1 year in a memory care center.
Wow.
Think about that.
Wow.
Okay. So if we can delay that, or maybe even delay that person's progression so they can die of something other than Alzheimer's disease, we're really, the plasma exchange would be much less expensive on a year-to-year basis than sitting, without your memory and without engagement with your family and without contributing externally to the world in more unique and personal ways. It's really no more expensive than that. It's far less expensive than that. So I think we really have to rethink the costs of healthcare. We have been in a disease treatment model. And if we shift to a health creation model, we need to start thinking about our health as our most important investment. Financial planners get this. I mean, oh my gosh, the number of patients I have that are financial planners are incredible. They're going like, yeah, this makes sense. The rest of what is going on out there, those are expenses. What I'm doing with you is an investment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Health is wealth.
Yeah, absolutely.
This has been fascinating. I mean, I think we said it a few times, but we definitely have to have a part two, part three, because there's a lot to talk about here. So we want to thank you for your time and leave you with the final wrap-up question and, go from there. And the question is just, really, is there a non-negotiable for you in your life that you have in place for your immunity?
Yeah. Love.
Amazing.
It's really love. I mean, if you are both in love and about love and for love, a lot of stress goes away. If you can decrease your stress, you decrease many of the triggers for immune activation. You decrease, you normalize your TH1, TH2 balance, decrease your sympathetic activation. The number of biologic ramifications of giving and receiving love and being in a state of thankfulness and gratitude are profound. And you know what? Nobody is without that as a potential. Sure. You can cultivate love in your life no matter where you are, no matter when you are. It doesn't matter what your economic status is, even your situation, you do have some influence of what's going on between your ears. And whatever you do on a daily basis, you will grow. And so if that sounds just way too challenging or like, oh my gosh, that's easy for you to say, yeah, take one step towards love. And I would say that's my non-negotiable.
Amazing.
Beautiful.
Well, you had me at the first 2 minutes, but
yeah,
I'm full right now for sure. It's been an awesome podcast for sure.
Well, Dr. Hasi, we love the work that you do. We love you. We think you're an amazing physician. Hope to be mentored by you, you know, a little bit more as our relationship develops. And we're so honored that you came on this podcast.
Oh, heck, it's my honor. This is great. And it's so awesome to know, I don't feel like a single voice in the wilderness anymore. There's so many more clinicians becoming interested in these ways of thinking and ways of practice. It's wonderful to have community, and it's great to see how it's affecting so many patients' lives. It has been so frustrating that, you know, we just don't have enough time we don't have enough slots to see all the patients that have come to our clinic. And we have to have more and more physicians that are dedicated towards the creation of health rather than just the diagnosis and treatment of disease.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that had all the necessary elements of an amazing podcast. I'm going to really challenge the listeners right now to go back and listen, because you're missing out if you missed this one. And the power of the one word answer at the end with the dramatic pause. Wow.
It was, yeah. I mean, all that was going through my mind was, you know, we just finished going down, I don't know, maybe what, 10, 15 minutes of like a really great rant in terms of plasma and all this stuff that is essentially, I mean, you guys get eyes way over my head. And then we get to the very last question, just love. Like, wow. It reminds me of the first series as well, right? Right back to the definition, right back to the basics.
Yeah, the cool thing is the overlap. Like, we're seeing patterns this early. So we just recorded one before this, and at the very end we did, you know, a love bomb meditation, so a love exercise, and it was kind of linked in with love here. There was a lot of things that Emily Fletcher spoke about, and they come from two very different camps, and yet the theme centered around love.
Yeah, and the challenge to the listeners is, you know, take this journey with us, because as we're pointing out things we've learned, we hope you learn the same thing too, and that's why we want you to go through all of these series and see what patterns you can find.
100%. I mean, I think the other thing too that struck me, I'm obviously a bit biased when it comes to the mental fitness, but just, you know, he brought up a few times about how important it is to understand individually, you know, who we are, who we want to be, and have that clarity as you're going into any type of treatment or, you know, health plans, like, just because, I mean, essentially that you pull back to, like, that's your purpose, that's your objective in getting healthy and performing at the best you can, right? So it's glad he brought that up. I'm glad we do that, obviously, at Thrive. But it's not talked about a lot anywhere else.
Mm-mm. Absolutely.
No, it's kind of echoing Dr. Conover in that first docuseries on longevity. He was kind of speaking along those same lines. But what was interesting to me was, how about those ancestral living principles coming back up again, showing themselves not only in longevity, but immunity. So we sound like a broken record by now, but get up and walk with the sunrise. Yeah. It's important. Set that circadian rhythm, community, laugh, love, live with a purpose. All those things are kind of innate ancestral wisdom that we need to cultivate again.
Yeah, the path to healthy is within you. That is the overarching statement we want you to learn, is that it is within you. You know, there are things that will help you, but most of it is already inside, innate. And let me say also, you know, I'm going to recap this again, but I was trying to get Dr. Hasi to say how he described his practice when he did it at the Wild Health Summit. But what he said was, I'm the guy that's going to allow patients to go as deep as they want to go on what they think their problem is. And, you know, he talked a long time about how his practice is unique. But what you're not reading between the lines is that it's very difficult to do in today's medical environment, because it does go a little bit against the grain. not from a practice standpoint, but from a philosophy standpoint. Like you said, you know, most people are practicing sick care, and he's way down on the other end trying to actually get to the root cause and make healthy people healthy again. It's not easy.
No.
For myself, and I know Rhett feels this way too, because I know him very well, but as we progress down this journey of growing and developing as physicians, he is a model good doctor. And I hope, and I know Rhett does as well, that we can continue to get to that point where we can be labeled as good doctors. And it's a heavy weight to carry, but it's beautiful. And I think the better we can do at growing as physicians and as human beings and compassionate individuals and love our patients, you know, the better off. Like we have on our website that we want to raise the collective of quality of care in the world. And we're hoping to do that. And we're learning ourselves, and we're learning from people like Dr. Hossie.
Yeah. And Mark, I was going to, this is obviously trying to not steal your thunder, but we just spoke about offline that this is the happy marriage between mental and physical, you know, and I think just to give the listeners a short story about how we met a long time ago at a random course. And the pattern that keeps coming up is the mind affects the body and the body affects the mind. So they are extremely interconnected. And if you don't believe it by now, we're going to show you over the next 30 podcasts as well, because it's going to keep coming up over and over again. So we're happy to have, you know, Mark on the team, and it's been awesome.
Yeah, right back at you guys. I mean, as you know, someone working in this space, like it just feels different, right? When you can be a part of the whole system and not just be so single focused on, all right, we're going to implement these mental fitness practices that you know work, just like you know certain medical interventions work. But like when they all, you know, speaking the same language, and we can work together on this stuff, I just find it fascinating and like limitless, essentially.
The body is a system of systems. Love that.
Yeah, that was good.
Reality is reality. Dude, I'm writing all this stuff down.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of good podcast titles in that one. All right, guys, to the next one.
All right.
All right, we need to make sure the lawyers are happy and make sure that this information is clear for everyone. So please bear with me. But the information on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. The statements and views expressed does not constitute a practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The Peak Health Unlock podcast disclaims any responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of the information contained herein. Opinions and views of the guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for any statements made by guests. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, and/or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their own healthcare professionals for any such conditions. If you do want to become a patient of Thrive Performance and Regenerative Medicine, please go to thrivemedicine.com to contact us, and we would be happy and honored to help you unlock your peak health. Thank you so much. Have a fantastic day.